Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
So my name is Preben. I'm CTO at Trifork. And with me, I have Johan Foss, author of the brand new book, Quantum Computing in Action. Welcome, Johan.
Thank you very much for having me.
In front of me here, I have a few books about quantum computing. And I guess at least one of them, I would say, is a must read within our industry. But your book is different from all of the books here. Why and how?
Well, I think there are a number of great books about quantum computing, and that's very important because the work on quantum computing could not be done so swiftly as it's been done now if there was no sharing of information. So many people are active in the area of quantum computing, and they do different things. And if you look at how classical computing evolved, then in the early days, it was mainly about the hardware and about how to create a computer. And gradually, the focus also moved to not just the hardware, but also the software. And then we had different computer languages. And on top of the computer languages, we created new computer languages. And then we created software patterns and new declarative languages and so on. So the moment that the root problems are more or less under control, then people tend to go higher up the stack. And if you want quantum computing to be very useful in the end, I believe we need to do a similar evolution. And that means that we have to slightly add more focus to the software aspects of quantum computing, by which I mean, how can we deal with existing software applications and still leverage quantum computing. So at this point, there are tens of millions of developers worldwide using different languages. And then the main question to me is, and that's what I try to address in the book, is how can we allow these millions of developers to take advantage of quantum computing without requiring them to get a PhD in quantum physics or so. So I really want all those developers to be able to leverage all the great work by people that wrote the other books and that are working on different aspects of quantum computing.
So you say there are tens of millions of developers out there working with different languages. You decided to go with Java here. Why?
Well, Java is the language that I'm most familiar with. And it's still one of the most popular languages in the world. It's been around for more than 25 years, and it's still around. So I think it's a safe bet for the future. There are other languages that come and go faster. And I want this book to have a long lifetime. So Java is in that sense a safe bet. It's also that there are about, well, on the last count, more than 12 million Java developers worldwide. And Java is used in many critical enterprise applications. And it might seem strange that you want to use to use an enterprise language for a topic that's mainly popular in research areas. But I think if we want quantum computing to succeed, it means that it has to reach the level of enterprise software. And throughout the years, Java learned a lot from being used in the enterprise. So if we want quantum computing to be leveraged in enterprise software, then it definitely helps to use it together with a language that knows all the in and outs of enterprise software, that knows how to deal with security, scalability, code maturity, and that also has a large developer base. And those Java developers are very familiar with a number of concepts. And by bringing quantum computing to those concepts, I think we can give 12 million developers a kickstart. It's that is not to say that there are no other languages that can benefit from Java. And I definitely think that C++ or C# or so are very good candidates as well. Python is obviously a great language to do research with quantum computing. But if we really want to bridge the gap between research and enterprise software, then I think Java is a safe bet.
If we draw a line back to the books I mentioned before, they seem to be centered around the crossfield between math and physics, maybe even philosophy. May I ask, what is your background?
I have a Master of Science in Civil Engineering. Actually, I'm a mining engineer. And I have a PhD in Applied Physics, which was done at the Faculty of Aerospace Engineering. So my Master of Science is deep under the ground, and my PhD is high above the ground. So that's funny, and it actually means that my background is in combining different things. And when I started to do my PhD, that was on acoustic wave theory, then I needed to do lots of calculations because there was lots of data, and I needed to do strong visualizations of this data. So I was searching for a language that could help me with this. And right at that moment, Java was released. So I looked into Java, and I wanted to do this on my Linux stations. There was no Java for Linux then. So I joined a small group called the Blackdown team and reported Java to Linux. And that's how I got in software. So I turned into software because I needed it for my scientific research. And then I got stuck in the software world, and I rolled from one challenge into the other, mainly software related. But the background, the real background on why I wanted to do this, to be able to process scientific data and to visualize it and to move things forward, that is something that I always liked. And with this book about quantum computing and with the strange quantum computing simulator that I wrote, I think I've gone full circle.
So you ported Java to Linux. We need to have a conversation about that one day. Sticking to your book, how much physics, how much math do I need to read it and to understand it?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's a question that I was asking myself every other week or so, because when I started the book, Manning wanted to have the description of the what they call the I think MQR. It is MQR, and I think it stands for minimal qualified reader. So what does the reader needs to know? And I know that if the basic requirements from a mathematical point double, then the potential reader target will be divided by 4 or so. So I tried to avoid the mathematical requirements, and not just because I want to have more readers, but also because I don't think it does matter to most of the developers. So you don't need to have a mathematical background to read the book and to run the samples. You don't need to know much about physics, definitely not about quantum physics. But for the interested reader, there is more background in the book about why are things the way they are. So for some developers, it doesn't matter. They just say, okay, so with this algorithm, I can search through a long unstructured list in polynomial time, for example, which is not entirely true, but And for others, they want to know why is this quantum approach much faster than the classical approach. And then it is explained with some very basic mathematics. But we don't go deep into the mathematical details. In order to write the book and the software behind it, I had to deep dive into the mathematics and the physics myself. And that's actually the best way to learn it. As I just read another tweet from the Richard Feynman Twitter account where he says, if you want to understand something, then teach it. So there is some, if you really want to deep dive into the algorithms in the book, then the book will also help you with the mathematics, but it's not required. And I think that for many Java developers or many enterprise developers, they are interested in it, but they, mainly I think as, something that they do out of interest and not because they need it to get a job done.
I completely agree. The best way to learn is to teach. Yes. Let's dive a little bit into the material of the book. What is polynomial time? What is exponential time?
Yeah, so that's that is one of the major aspects of quantum computing, that it can deal with problems. Some problems that would typically take exponential time, that quantum computing can deal in polynomial time. So to try to explain it briefly, if you have a problem and you have an algorithm that will solve the problem, then typically the bigger the problem, the longer it will take before you have a solution. For example, if I have to sort 10 numbers from high to low, it will take some time. If I have 100 numbers, that will obviously take much more time than solving the 10 numbers. And the amount by which problems become more complex, if the number of if the input parameters become larger, that is expressed in the time order of that problem. And there are some problems that are of exponential time with the best known classical algorithms, which means that if you have a classical computer and he can solve a given problem in 2 minutes, then by making the problem three times as hard, it will require, for example, 8 times more time. And by making it 4 times as hard, it might require 16 times more time. I think most people by now understand what exponential behavior is because of the coronavirus. Unfortunately, also multiplicate itself in using exponential behavior, and we unfortunately we most people now realize that if something seems to go slow in the beginning, it can go extremely fast when things get more complex. This is a bad example of exponential behavior, but a good example is, for example, in cryptography, when we want to create cryptography keys, then we see that if we make them very small, it's easy to hack them. But if we add a few bits, then it becomes harder and harder, and it becomes exponentially harder. So that is a problem that we can, I'm making some shortcuts here, but that we can define as exponential time behavior. Now, in a quantum computer, some of those non-polynomial problems might be executed still in polynomial time, which means that we make the problem harder and the quantum computer will need more time to solve it, but not exponentially more time. It might take more, if we make the problems 4 times as hard, it might take 8 times more time, but if we make it 8 times as hard, then it might take only 16 times the original time. So it will still become more complex, but it won't behave like this exponential curve that we all know so well now. And that is a game changer, because some problems are known to be of exponential complexity, and they cannot be solved with even the biggest supercomputers in the world, even if all the classical computing power is combined. Those problems are too hard to solve. And a quantum computer might be able to solve these very, very hard problems. And the typical example of this is encryption. I want to stress that this is a very important example, but it's definitely not the only application of quantum computing. But with the best classical computers, it's nearly impossible to break strong RSA encryption. But with a quantum computer, it is possible once the quantum computers are powerful enough, which may take a long, long time. And more important, by adding a few bits, the classical problem would become exponentially more complex. But in quantum computing, just adding a few bits is not going to make you exponentially more secure. So it's a thing that's hard to explain, but therefore I use the example of encryption and the coronavirus, because I think that people can somehow understand what it means if a problem is exponential.
And I think it's important to emphasize that a quantum computer is a calculator. It's not just a supercomputer, it's a calculator, and it's very suited for a specific type of mathematical problems. So the idea is that you have this problem with a huge complexity. It can kind of transfer it or turn it around, move it into the quantum space, and then it becomes solvable for the quantum computer. And in order to do that, we need to understand about quantum gates, for instance. What is a gate? What is a quantum gate?
All right, so just like a classical computer consists of a number of gates, a quantum computer consists of gates as well. So in classical computing, the high-level programming languages are built on top of low-level languages and on machine coding. And ultimately, it's based on the flow of current that passes or not passes through a transistor. And the gates there are then, for example, the NOT gate that will invert the zero into one and vice versa, or an AND gate, XOR gate, and so on. And in quantum computing, we have gates as well. So that concept can somehow be compared to the concept of classical gates. The main difference, though, between quantum computing and classical computing is that in classical computing, we use bits, where a bit can have the value 0 or 1. 0 means no current, and 1 means maybe 5 voltage or so. And in quantum computing, we don't use bits, but we use qubits, where a qubit can hold the value of 0. It can hold the value of 1, but it can also hold a linear combination of 0 and 1. So, and that's not to say that it can be, for example, 0.7. It actually means that when I would measure this qubit, there's maybe 30% chance that I will measure a 0 and 70% chance that I will measure a 1. So you can measure 0 or you can measure 1, but you don't, but whereas in classical computing, it's always clear that it's either one or the other. And in quantum computing, we talk more about probabilities. And the gates that operate in quantum computers deal with these probabilities. And therefore, if you apply a gate to a qubit, the result is, the qubit is still there. But instead of just two states, the qubit can be in many states. And that makes the gates a bit more tricky to create in quantum computing than in classical computing. But it also offers for great performance improvements, because what you said is exactly the point. Quantum computers are no supercomputers. It's not that they do more calculations. It's just that they are able to do, and this is scientifically not really correct, but they are able to do many computations in parallel.
So a quantum gate needs to be reversible. Is that a quantum mechanical property, or is it more like a definition that we have made?
No, it's actually what nature dictates us. And that is another important difference between quantum gates and classical gates. A classical gate is more or less, well, human-made. So we created, in particle terms, a huge device named the transistor, which is a few nanometers. But it's huge compared to the world of the very small particles. And the elements that we have in quantum computing are the elementary particles. And in quantum mechanics, everything is reversible. So there is no, well, it's because of the laws of quantum mechanics that the equations hold in both time directions. And as a consequence, if you want to use the fundamental cornerstones of nature to create a computer, whatever we do there must be reversible as well, because the elements that we use are reversible. So if we are thinking about a gate, we have to take into account that if we want to create this gate with building blocks from nature, that the gate needs to be reversible. Otherwise, we can't construct it. And that is it is a challenge because it makes some gates harder. For example, a classical gate, an AND gate, has two inputs and one output. But we can't have that in quantum computing, because if we then have the outputs, we can't go back to the two inputs, because there are many, well, in the case of two input bits and one output bit, and if one of the input bits is zero, the other is one, the output is going to be one. But you can't go back and say that the first input was one or the second input was one. That information is lost if you apply the classical gate. So therefore, that is something that that gate is impossible to realize in quantum computing. Of course, you can do arithmetic in quantum computing, but then you need slightly different gates with two output qubits, for example, where the second qubit has the information that otherwise would have been lost.
And I need to say to the viewers here that all of this may sound very abstract, but trust me, if you read the book, it all makes sense. But talking about the gates, it leads me into another question, and that is the oracle. What is an oracle?
Apart from being a software company, an oracle is very relevant in quantum computing, because it is sort of what I call a quantum black box. It is something that is given to you by someone else or by a phenomenon in nature or so, and you don't know what is inside it. And you actually are not interested what is inside it, but you want to know its characteristics. And you can't open that black box, but you can query it, which means you can provide some input and you can measure the output. So in a quantum oracle, when you know that quantum oracle, for example, has five input qubits and also five output qubits, you can try different combinations of qubits, and you can then measure what that oracle gives as an output. And based on the input-output parameters, you can more or less understand what is happening inside that quantum oracle. And that is, well, comparable with the black box. And a basic example for this, which we discuss in the book as well, is suppose that you have a classical function that will always be either balanced or constant, which means that suppose that, well, that will either give in half of the times as the result of an operation a zero, and in half of the times it will give a one. In that case, we call that a balanced function. And a constant function is when it will always give a zero or it will always give a one. So we are given a function, but we don't know is this a constant or a balanced function. And suppose that we have 8 different input scenarios, then we need to do at least 5 evaluations of this black box function before we can tell with certainty if this is if the black box is hiding a constant or a balanced function. 5 evaluations, because after 4 evaluations, we might still have 4 times 0, but it can be that the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th will give a 1, in which case it is a constant, it is a balanced function. And with a quantum oracle, you can create a quantum oracle that's mimicking this classical function, but you can prove that you need only 1 evaluation to, if you have 2 qubits, it's 1 evaluation and it adds to that. But you need, the thing is that in quantum computing, you can send, instead of trying first all zeros and then all zeros and 1, 1 and then different combinations, you can send more or less all combinations at the same time by putting the qubits in what is called a superposition, which is the qubits then have as value a linear combination of 0 and 1. So they can be measured as 0 or they can be measured as 1. If all those qubits are in a superposition and you send them to the oracle, then the oracle is, and again, this is scientifically, I know that if there are real scientists listening, that they might say, no, it's not really happening, but I try to make it visually more comprehensible by taking some shortcuts. I would say that you can compare it that the oracle is evaluating all the possibilities at once, and it will then give 1 outcome. So it is, and that's where the speed up comes from. Instead of evaluating all zeros and then all ones or so, it evaluates all options at simultaneously. And that is why a quantum oracle is often used for dealing with complex applications, because you can understand what is happening inside the quantum oracle by feeding it a specific configuration of qubits where a superposition is extremely important.
And trust me, once again, all of this makes sense once you read the book. And I'm going to leave this as a cliffhanger here, that this is very important for one of the most famous algorithms, Grover's search algorithm, understanding quantum oracles. And all of this has been supported beautifully by the examples, by the code examples in the book, which leads me to, you claim pretty early in the book that by using this quantum simulator, we will be able to write programs. And the day we have quantum hardware, it's pretty much just changing a variable and then it runs on real hardware. Is that really so?
Yes, absolutely. And that was one of the most important design goals. And I think it is extremely important and it is very well possible now because of the long history that we have with classical computing and with computer languages like Java. In Java, you do not program against a specific implementation, but you program against APIs and interfaces. So a Java developer uses the top-level Java APIs to write an application, and it does not matter then if that application is ultimately being executed on a Windows system or a Mac or a Linux or an embedded device or a mobile device or so. It's under the hood. The instructions from the developer are translated into the low-level machine-specific instructions. And this holds with Strange as well, the quantum simulator that I wrote. So it will, by default, search for the quantum simulator that it's bundled with. But you can also run your application on a different execution environment, which is called the quantum execution environment. And those execution environments will translate your application into something that's specific for a specific execution environment. And that an execution environment can be a real quantum computer, which I don't have right now. But it can also be a quantum simulator that is running on your local desktop, or it can be a quantum simulator that is running in the cloud. And that is what makes it powerful and future-proof, that the moment that a real quantum computer is available, your application does not need to change, because the gates that your application is using have representations in both simulators, cloud computers, as well as real-world quantum computers. So that is actually the root idea of Java was Borja, write once, run anywhere. And that is what we bring now to quantum computing as well. And that is not extremely new, by the way. One of the other projects that I'm the co-leader of the OpenJFX project in the Java world, where we define the Java APIs for user interfaces. And the implementation of that project will use the GPU, if there's a GPU available on the device that you're using, your laptop or desktop or phone or so. And if there's no GPU, it will use the CPU and will do software emulation. And that principle is exactly the same as what we do in Strange with quantum computing. So we could search if there is a real quantum processor. And if so, we are going to use it. And otherwise, we use the software fallback or so. So that is something that we learned by doing software many, many years, and that we can now leverage to make quantum computing already possible even before we have real physical quantum computers, which is extremely important, in my opinion, that we start working on quantum computing now and not just wait till the moment that there are many powerful quantum computers.
That would actually be my next question, because you kind of revealed that we don't have the quantum computers yet. So why should we care now?
Yeah, there are a couple of reasons for it. And I think it's important to realize that even if you're extremely smart, it will still take a while before you come up with the best ways to introduce quantum computing in your applications. It is a totally new way of thinking. You need to think in a different way than you think when solving classical problems. And you need to understand when quantum computing can be applicable and when it is not applicable. So that's also something I want to make clear. Quantum computing is not applicable to all kinds of problems. So there are definitely problems that that a quantum computer will never be able to solve in a good way. So to find out which parts of your existing or new software should benefit from quantum computing, that is going to take time. And time is might be critical. For example, if it's not certain yet, but if quantum computers will one day be able to crack RSA encryption, then you don't want to wait until that point before you start looking into your encryption. You can use quantum computing to create secure communication, but you can't switch overnight. For example, if it's announced, and I don't think there will be a big announcement when a company or a government or a nation has a powerful quantum computer that can break RSA encryption, and the next morning your encryption is not using classical encryption standards anymore, but is using a quantum encryption, that's going to take a long, long time. And even if it's going to take a long time before quantum computers can do that, it will also take a long time before your organization will be ready for it. And I often compare that with the Y2K bug, the Millennium bug, where it was clear that at December 31, 1999, that there would be a problem. And companies didn't wait until December 26, 1999. At least most companies didn't wait. Some waited a bit too long, but most were prepared ahead of time. And that effort started years in advance. And it was actually very needed. And the reason that we have that we didn't see many problems with the Y2K bug is because of exactly this, companies started to prepare years in advance, investigated their existing software, searched for vulnerabilities, and came up with solutions ahead of time. There was the advantage of, well, you could predict very well when the millennium bug would happen. It's a bit harder to predict when quantum computers will be powerful enough to break encryption. But it's not only a negative story, it's also a positive story. So imagine that there are quantum computers powerful enough to do great things in medicine, healthcare, chemistry, or physics. And so you don't want to wait until that moment before you start thinking about, and how can I then write software that will take advantage of this? So therefore, it's already good to start thinking about the software now and start writing algorithms and run them on a very small scale or on a quantum simulator or so. Because if you can prove that the new algorithm on a quantum computer will require polynomial time instead of exponential time, as we discussed in the beginning, then you know that you're on the right track. And then you know that once quantum computers are there, that your software will be very, very usable. So it's there's no reason why this software research cannot be done in parallel with the hardware evolutions. And if you want to get a head start for when quantum computers are really available, then you better start yesterday working on the software.
So let's stop circling around the big question. Let's go into it. When will we have quantum computers?
I keep circling around. It's this is the billion-dollar question. Well, actually, the answer is the unfair answer is easy. We already have quantum computers today. So there are a number of quantum computers. IBM even has a few quantum computers in a public cloud that you can access. Google has a quantum computer. And then there
when will we have useful quantum computers? Let's put it that way.
So this is the point where I will be crucified later probably. But I think... between 5 and 10 years from now, we will have quantum computers that will really be able to solve problems that that are totally unsolvable today. And that will be be complete game changers. But between now and then, there will be other applications of quantum computing that will be very useful. And I personally think that in the not too distant future, we will be able to benefit from the quantum internet. And that combined with small quantum computers can drastically change the way we think about encryption. And for example, at Delft University of Technology, there's a consortium working on the quantum internet where entangled qubits are sent to two different computers. So even if those computers are very small quantum computers, because they are connected with each other on a quantum internet, they might become more powerful. And especially there are many things that you can do even with just a few qubits. So I think that it won't take 5 years before we are going to see practical applications on a limited scale of quantum computing. The big things, like for example, solving the protein folding problem or breaking RSA encryption, that's going to take more than 5 years, I think. But you never know what's going to be invented. And that is also one of the main reasons why I really want all those tens of millions of developers to look into quantum computing and to learn about it, because maybe one of these readers has an idea and says, hey, but if we can actually find the periodicity of a function with this algorithm, we also might use this for this or this problem, and that will then be a dramatic boost in some material design or in some medical investigation. And so it's a new world, the world of quantum algorithms. And the more people that are working on this, the better. And if some of these problems require thousands or millions of qubits, but maybe some require can be useful with less qubits. And I believe that there will be problems that will be that will lead to immediate benefits without having without requiring millions of qubits.
Thank you. It has been so inspiring speaking with you, and just as inspiring reading your book. Thanks a lot. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.